The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Michael is an international business lawyer and consultant who has also been the CEO of three international companies. Michael has also written three books, one of which is about how Nelson Mandela realized his own dreams to become an iconic winner who saved a nation. In today's show, join Michael in a conversation with his guest, a winner who has also made a difference for the better in the lives of those he or she has touched. Michael and his guest will offer some insight that might well help you realize your own dreams. Now, here is your host, Michael Friedlander.
Well, hi, I am Michael Friedlander, and I'd like to welcome you to our show today. I have with me Professor Diane Swanson, who is Professor of Management and the Edgerly Family Chair of Distinction at Kansas State University, where she chairs the Business Ethics Education Initiative. I also have with me Steve Burrows, CBE, honored by Her Majesty the Queen for his contributions to civil and structuring engineering around the world. And Steve, meet Diane. Diane, meet Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Hello, Diane.
Good to meet you.
You too. How are you?
Oh, it's a beautiful day, and I'm well. It's about 66 degrees in Kansas right now.
You sound so happy.
Yeah,
we can't allow that to continue, I'm afraid. We're going to have to. You've got to be miserable and sort of downbeat like us.
Well, anytime we can talk about ethics is a good day for me. And I know that's true for you all, too.
You've got to get a life, Diane. In case you were worried, Diane, we should probably forego all formalities. You don't have to call Steve Commander, Diane. Steve, you don't have to call a professor. Neither of you need to call me Your Highness or Excellence.
Well, we won't, Michael. But Michael, you are starting to scare me.
Really?
Because you started to invite people as guests who actually know what they're talking about. And that's a scary idea, right?
That's a slippery slope, indeed.
You never told me that when we started this.
I'll be nice.
No, Diane.
Yeah, please, be gentle.
Diane, no. You don't have to do that. Anyway, so last week, Steve and I spoke about ethics and getting beyond these beautifully written codes of conduct. And I warned Steve last week that you would be listening to that show, and that you would be harshly critical of almost anything that he said, and that he had to be very careful and on his best behavior.
I was.
Yeah, so I would urge you.
You were, Steve. I agree.
Thank you very much.
And I would urge you, please, Diane, not to be nice to him or polite, because I stopped doing that years ago.
I think we'll have a good engagement. Two-way, yeah.
Okay, so I thought what we would call today's show, that corporate responsibility thing, challenging the executive mind, and I outrageously plagiarized the name of your new book, Diane.
Thank you.
Which maybe you can talk about. And because rumor has it that Steve is an executive mind, I'm not sure about that, but I believe he makes that claim somewhere. I thought it might be an interesting conversation. So let me just ask you this, just for starters. You listened to the show last week.
I did.
Any thoughts come to mind?
Well, two things come to mind. First, I was struck by how Steve discussed the importance of trust in relationships, because that's something we try to impart to students in business schools, but it's better if they hear from practitioners on how that actually functions and why it's important. And I know, Michael, you talked about the importance of being truthful, and I recall your example of the Rolex watch in that regard. And then the other thing that came to mind is, as I recall, there was some criticism of business schools and rightly so, in that business schools as a whole are not delivering ethics and corporate responsibility on the level needed. So those things come to mind immediately.
Diane, one thing that, you know, you just said that maybe business schools are teaching the wrong thing, but that really wasn't, you know, my point really was not so much that you're teaching the wrong thing, but that if business school students are prepared to cheat in exams, then there's something so fundamentally flawed that people who are going to be the captains of industry are prepared to cheat to get there. That says to me that prior to going to school, what's gone wrong with their moral compass?
Oh, yes, I recall that now. And I believe either Steve or Michael, there was a citation of the fact that it has been found that business students cheat more than students in other schools. And that's empirically validated. There's been more than one study on that. Yeah, but I don't know if that's some of us think that might be a self-selection process. You know, that those who are inclined to cheat might enroll in business schools rather than philosophy. There's that angle. But I think, Steve, you just went to the angle of the broader culture, didn't you?
I did. You know, I'm sort of saying that, you know, you should be able to not moderate a business examination. You know, people should be so much above it. You know, it just seems to me that it's a fundamental requirement of somebody who's going to lead a business that they're ethically, they have an ethical stance. And that if they're prepared to cheat in exams, I'm sort of finding myself saying, well, you know, they're on the wrong course, aren't they?
Steve, are you suggesting that people shouldn't cheat in writing their ethics exams?
Touche.
Yeah. I'm saying they shouldn't cheat at all. And you know, it's a bit like, I mean, if you said that somebody was going to become a surgeon and they were doing their surgery final practical examination and they decided to cheat, we'd all be horrified, wouldn't we? Because we'd say, you know, how can you cheat if you're a surgeon? You've got to do it right. There's only one way. And isn't there only one way to do business? I mean, am I naive there? Is there a way to do business where do cheats prosper in business? And are people sort of admiring the success of the cheats and wanting to emulate it?
Can I answer that question?
Please.
Sure.
Empirically, the answer to that is clearly yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, there is a culture of cheating. I don't think there's any question about that. Diane, wouldn't you agree with it?
I do. I do agree with that. And I think it cuts across the sector. You know, sectors. It's in athletics, and I don't follow sports very much, quite frankly, but I do follow the news, and I see where there's cheating in sports, and there's problems in some churches, and there's problems in some not-for-profits, and so I think this goes to Steve's point about the broader culture that we're in, and how a lot of people in business become wealthy by working on, at minimum, the gray areas. And not all end the way Enron and Arthur Andersen ended. So I think there is a problem. And to piggyback on that, I do wish we could screen our prospective students for cheating. But what we seem to be left with is once we have them in the classroom, the path is to take students to the honors court and let the problem be adjudicated there.
But I think sports a great example, actually, because there are sports where cheating is absolutely not accepted. So golf, you know, golfers, there are instances of golfers hitting the ball twice by accident and nobody can catch it. You can't see it on film. Only the golfer knew. And they admit it. They take the penalty. Because the sport itself is fundamentally about doing the right thing. And I think cricket is another example that, you know, there have been cases of cheating and those people have been completely ousted from the sport. Whereas in soccer, cheating is just endemic. And it's almost the people cheat all the time. And it's the referee's job to catch the cheats. So I think sport says to me some sports, just by way they've set them up, have stopped the cheats, and other sports allow them to prosper. Where does business stand on this? Is business just over, you know, the people who moderate business, are they accepting of cheating?
By that, do you mean the, there are some levels here, like you might be talking about the regulators, you might be talking about the public policy makers. I think there's a problem, at least in this country, with the idea that we need to deregulate business. And that's kind of a broad topic. But the reason I'm saying that is, in terms of cheating, is that what we find using theories of moral development and moral reasoning, that most of us, most of the time, reason in what's called a conventional level, where we look to the rules and our peer group for how we conduct ourselves. Does that make sense? So the point is, and I'm not talking about you, Steve, or you, Michael. I'm talking about, that's what the empirical evidence is telling us about most people in society most of the time, at least in this society. And we might argue it's even more so in societies that register highly on individualism, which happens to be the U.S. and Australia, if we look at the globe. We're the most highly individualistic societies by all the empirical evidence. So one might argue that in individualistic societies, we need to have more rules and norms than if we were collectivistic. So if you're talking about regulation, to me, a lot of roads do lead to public policy. And I'm aware that there were Senate hearings, if you look at sports, on the doping epidemic. You both are probably aware of that, which I consider cheating, right? Doping, the steroids and all that.
Yeah, no.
No, that's right.
Yeah, no, it's cheating. And of course, what they're doing in, if you pick cycling, you know, what they're trying to do is to, you know, they expose the cheats and clean up the sport. But in business, if people are cheating in exams in business school, it must be because they believe that they're able to cheat in their jobs afterwards and prosper. Yeah. And there's something wrong there, isn't there? Cheats shouldn't prosper.
Yeah, Steve, let me just use that as a segue for a larger and quite unfair question I'm going to ask Diane.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I'm a great believer in magic wands. And I'm going to give you, Diane, a magic wand.
Oh.
And if you could wave that magic wand and say to Steve, this is what you need to do to improve the ethical culture of your firm. And I'm not talking about creating another written code. I'm not talking about creating rules. I'm talking about creating an atmosphere in which ethics will, I don't want to say thrive, but will improve. Let's be modestly optimistic here. What would you do?
Well, and thank you for that magic wand. In my reply, I'm not saying that Steve doesn't do the following, but I owe a debt to Ed Schein at MIT, who's done a lot of consulting in this area, and I borrowed some of his concepts for my book. So Ed Schein, in working with companies to try to actually improve ethical cultures, he gives us the following, which I think we all already know, but he says there are primary mechanisms that executives can use, and those are the most important. And it's like, where is the money allocated? You know, is there a budget for code enforcement? And is there a budget for a vice president of compliance and an ethics officer? And is there a budget for reports and follow through? And on that side, so to speak, because I'm seeing a column in my mind, and on the left side is the primary mechanisms that Ed Schein says must be in place. So another one is how the executives respond to crises, because this says to the whole organization, this is how we need to behave. And another is who is promoted and recruited and rewarded. And this speaks volumes, right? And if we look at Enron, we can see that the wrong people were recruited and promoted and rewarded, in terms of creating an ethical culture, at least arguably. And then, of course, there's the executive who walks the talk. And in that side of primary mechanisms, one area that comes into view is human resource management. Because if I could wave that magic wand, I would have human resource management give employees and incoming employees or prospective employees, that would be even better, a test of moral reasoning, of moral development. They're out there. The instruments have been validated. And I would hire for those employees who exhibit an expanded idea of the values that are important in an ethical organization. Then Ed Schein says on that other side of the ledger, which visually to me is the right-hand side, there are secondary reinforcement mechanisms that on their own won't do anything. And these include rituals and awards for ethical behavior. And
to me, that all seems a little too ritualistic, just in my mind. And to me, this seems like a bit of an over-ritualistic, if that's a word, approach to it. Because in my mind, from my experience, if you have a kid who's been cheating through school, cheating through high school, through college, through business school, I don't think it's going to have much of an impact if you have a code of conduct or you have a human resources person or you give him another test. Mm-hmm. I just don't see it. And in fact, and I hate to speak well of Steve, it really does bother me, and it's not easy. But but listening to him on last week's show provide the example of how when he was asked to pay somebody $200,000 to sign off on a permit and he refused to do so, that's to me is an inspirational story that does more than anything that a human resources person could do and anything more than a test could do. And it just seems to me that if I use my own magic wand, it would be directed at leaders like Steve, who would lead by example and who would make it very, very clear that certain kinds of conduct are just not acceptable.
Yes, and perhaps I didn't emphasize enough that on that side, as you will, of primary mechanisms, the leader walking the talk is very, very important. So it's not surprising to me that Steve gives that example. It's laudatory. But I personally expect that from engineers at their best.
Yeah, well, because engineers are closer to godliness, as we all know. And,
excuse me, Steve. Steve, we need a little time just to recover from what you've been saying.
You can absorb that, but it is a fact.
I'm getting up off the floor.
But I tell you, you know, one of the things that I think, I mean, first of all, I think I listen to what you say, Diane, and I think it's, it is about fairness. I think that a lot of people, if they see that people are promoted for the right things, then it sends the right message. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but you accept my proposal that engineers are closer to godliness?
Well, after I got up off the floor,
we're almost, I think, at the end of the first segment, but it's very rare that I'm rendered speechless.
By the godly man.
and thank you, Michael. I've got to go now, and it's a great way to end the show. I think this is possibly, you know, the whole reason why we did this thing.
Well, when we come back, I'd like to talk a little about something that Diane and I touched on briefly, I think, in a conversation we had a couple of days ago, or was it yesterday, in which I just asked the question of why criminology wasn't taught in the business schools, because after all, the criminologists are the ones who do studies into why the white-collar criminals do what they do, and there are an awful lot of white-collar criminals flowing through business school, no? So, don't go away, we'll be back soon.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. Tune in Tuesdays and join the credit master and consumer advocate, Mr. D, a.k.a. Bruce J. Danielson, and learn the whole truth about credit risk scoring, collectors, both kinds, credit bureaus, credit cards, tax liens, mortgages, and much more. Find out how to use accountability combat to protect yourself from becoming a victim and to fight back against corporate abusers, such as banksters who have taken unfair advantage of most of us. The Consumer Fight Back Show educates consumers on how to find relief within today's onerous credit system. See you Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Dance Talk Radio has come to Voice America. Join host Tracy Marciniak and her celebrity guests every week for a show that takes you inside the world of dance. What's it like working with stars like Katy Perry and Taylor Swift? The experts share their stories and the behind-the-scenes secrets. Plus, inside tips to become a better dancer, instructor, or studio owner. Dance on over to the Voice America Variety Channel every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific for Dance Talk Radio.
If you are interested in real estate in America's largest city or anywhere, be sure to listen for Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco. Although our focus is on Manhattan and other real estate markets in and around New York City, we'll have plenty of information that will help you successfully buy, sell, and close a transaction no matter where you are in the world. Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco can be heard every Tuesday at 9 a.m. in New York, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Okay, guys, well, yeah, I'm really happy to tell you that we're actually back for the second segment. Wasn't that wonderful? our time does fly when you're having fun. Okay, so let's just sort of keep going from where we were. I mean, I think, one of the things, Steve... Diane and I chatted just briefly yesterday, and I was talking about how surprised I was that criminology is not taught in the business schools, because what the criminologists do is that they look at the excuses or the rationalizations that white collar criminals have made for their behavior, and it just strikes me that would be a really interesting way to educate these business kids as to how they should look at things. So for example, some white collar criminals have one of the topics of neutralization that they refer to is an appeal to higher loyalty. So the criminal would argue that his act was not motivated by self interest, but was motivated by higher loyalties or loyalty to his employer or friends or family. He would argue that everyone's doing it, therefore he was entitled to do it. There's a claim There's a claim to entitlement where, because he's not getting paid as much as somebody else, therefore he was entitled to skim. And then when anybody impugns his actions, it's called condemnation of the condemners. They attack the people condemning them. Mm-hmm. I found as a business executive, looking back, that these are all red flags. That when people start using these excuses, you got a problem with them.
Right.
And I'm just curious why, if the business schools had to choose between teaching ethic through the ancients, like Immanuel Kant or the utilitarians, if they had to choose between teaching them ethics through that or teaching them through the criminologists who've made a study of why people do what the guys at Enron did, why they don't go the criminology route?
Well, if there's a choice of either or, I would go the social science route, which does include criminology. And because what you're talking about, and I think we discussed this briefly yesterday, is in criminology and in social science, there's a fraud triangle. And what you just talked about was one tip of that triangle, in that criminals rationalize their behavior in some way. In terms of what you said, an appeal to higher loyalty and entitlement.
Yeah, my view is that if you sort of got to go back to the whole point of having a business. If the purpose of your business is just to make money. The sole purpose of the company is to make profit, then for me, you're at risk of people making some bad choices. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the sole, our business is about, first of all, building relationships. So, our business only survives through long-term business relationships. And we talked about that a lot in the last show. And that people enjoy the process. They enjoy the work that goes along with that. So we believe we're making a positive contribution to society. And those are the overwhelming drivers that people do good work and they have great relationships with their clients. The third thing is we make a profit. We're not driven by that third thing. It is a consequence of the other two. And if you're totally driven by the sort of profit, then I think you can find short-term, quicker ways to get from A to B and make a profit. And what I would say is you're highly unlikely to have a sustainable long-term business by doing that. And so you'll be constantly looking for new clients. But there's no doubt there are shortcuts. We just choose not to take them because we actually enjoy the process and we actually enjoy the relationships. And so that's why most people come to work. That's what they're doing, 99% of the time. They're doing the process. They're undertaking it in an enjoyable way and they're working with people that they like. And I think that at business schools, what you've got to do is you've got to really get right to the core of why businesses exist and make sure that people focus on those things. And then I think they'll make better choices. I mean, it's still down to all of this is about giving people a conscience, however you define that, but giving people the tools to make the right decision. And that's for me what a conscience is. It allows you in any scenario to apply some basic rules and make the right decision. And that's what we want people to do. We don't want to police everything, because why do we have to do that? We don't want to write books on it that people have to read and follow. We really want to give them the tools to make their own decisions, but the right ones.
Diane, Steve and I spoke a few shows ago about motivation. And I had just finished reading Daniel Pink's book. And one of the things that he says right at the end of the book, which I thought was absolutely, fascinating, is he said that, people have to have autonomy. You need to tell them the direction in which they have to go, but you have to let them decide how to get there and with whom they work and all this other stuff. But the other thing he said, too, is that this idea of too much control is really not a good idea. And funnily enough, he used ethics as an example. Mm-hmm. He said people have got to be ethical because they understand why. And that if companies start creating codes and checklists, what people tend to do is they think, well, because we have completed the checklist, we're okay. Mm-hmm. And they fail to look at the bigger picture. And he uses the example, I think, of equal opportunity. And he says they're checklists. Well, he says, they fill the checklist, they feel good, but actually there's a much greater spirit involved and a higher motive. And I think the real challenge, it seems to me anyway, what do I know? But it seems to me that the challenge is to inculcate in students that there is a higher purpose and it's not just a rote checklist kind of thing.
Right. You're reminding me of something our executive in residence at Kansas State said. I team teach with the gentleman, and he retired recently as a senior executive vice president at ConocoPhillips. So we team teach the professional ethics course together. He has a long career and involving as an accountant, submitting reports to the Security and Exchange Commission, serving on boards, etc. And he told the students, he said, there is a danger in formalizing everything and having a rule for everything. And for just the reasons you said, Michael, so I won't repeat it, I agree with that. So it kind of, to me, boils down to, are the students broad-minded enough in their decision-making processes, or have they adopted a myopia? And as an example, have they considered the interests of a broad array of stakeholders who have a vested interest in the decision, or are they just going by one view? And so I'm agreeing with you. It's the decision-making processes, the approach that ultimately matters.
Now, Steve will tell you that a requirement for being on the show is to agree with me. So you didn't.
Oh, come. I see. I see.
Yeah, it's in the contract. It's something clause 34B, subsection C.
Now you tell me.
Yeah, it's page 325.
Oh, yeah. Footnote number two. Right. I would like to cite both of you tonight. I teach a course in managing the triple bottom line on the MBA level, and I'm teaching tonight. And I'm absorbing everything you're saying, and going back to the value of stakeholder relationships, long-term stakeholder relationships, that's the topic tonight, in fact. And it goes back to what happened in the 1970s with the idea of people, profit, and planet. That became the triple bottom line way of thinking about business. I don't know if you would agree with that, but that's what this class is about, that we look at profit, we look at the environment, and we look at the social relationships. And sometimes there's a way to satisfy all, but the goal is the long-term success built on long-term relationships. That's what the triple bottom line course is about. So I'm going to end up citing both of you, not in the holiness way, if you don't mind, but in the examples you've been giving.
Well, we can tell you where to send the royalty checks. So that's okay.
Right. I have a question for both of you, because I because of the fact that I'm teaching this course and doing some projects related to it. I'm following the new benefit. Well, it's pretty new. The new benefit corporation in the United States. It's a new charter. It actually goes back to the first charters for corporations in this country, but that faded away, and now about 27 states have adopted a triple bottom line charter for corporations who want to be incorporated that way, and they're triple bottom line corporations. So the stockholders cannot sue for not maximizing profits because people were considered in the decision. And so that's sort of it, in terms of the theme of the show, dreamers. And I have a dream that trend will become more and more pronounced, especially because people in other countries are looking at it. So I wanted to offer that as a development worth watching.
Yeah, I am familiar with those new corporations, but it does seem to me that whatever the entity is, whatever the structure is, the most important thing is for all the stakeholders to be on the same page, and that applies to nonprofits, for example. I had this conversation with my son the other day, and he was talking about nonprofits, and I was trying to explain to him that a nonprofit company isn't a company that doesn't make profit. Mm-hmm. and there's a popular misconception here. A nonprofit company is simply a company that isn't taxed on its profits. Mm-hmm. But nonprofit companies make huge profit. And, you just look at what some of these senior executives are earning for running these nonprofits. They're doing a great job. I'm not criticizing them at all. For all these companies, though, isn't the real issue what it does with those profits? But I think it all boils down, and I hate agreeing with Burroughs. It bothers me, but it all boils down. No, it does. It does. It offends me. I can't bring myself to feel comfortable about this.
I'll get used to it, Michael.
No, no. It all boils down to what the company is doing and why it's doing it.
The mission.
Yeah, it really depends on that. And I think that, one of the points of the show was that you can't be a winner without having made a difference for the better in the lives of people you touch. The mere fact that you made a ton of money, in my mind, doesn't make you a winner. Mm-hmm. You can make no money and be a winner. But that has to be your raison d'etre, if you like. It has to be your reason for getting up in the morning. And if you have stakeholders who agree with that, then you have exactly the entity that you're dreaming about, Diane. But it depends on, my feeling is that life's all about expectation. You tell your other half that you're going to be home at 7:30 and you're home at 8, you're dead. If you tell her you're going to be home at 8 and you're home at 7:30, you're a hero. It's all about expectations. And I think that the key is really kind of what Steve is saying, is that everybody has to be on the same page. Everybody has to understand what it is you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I think, but you know, when and I don't mean to be critical, Diane, but you know, when you explain these things, it seems to be overly complex to me. Mm-hmm. You know, the simple idea, and we talked about this on a previous show, but you know, the idea of life is to be happy, right? And you know, it's an easy thing to say; it trips off the tongue. But you know, basically, people when they come to work, they want to be happy, they want to have fun, they want to be with their friends. And yes, they want to earn the money to be able to live a decent life. But they don't come to work just for the money. All those other things are equally important. And the purpose of a business is to, you know, fulfill a need. But people want to enjoy the process, and they want to enjoy the relationships. And I think that applies whether you work in a subway or you know, sandwich shop, or you're working on a train, or you're working in a business. And I think if you have to police this or write codes of ethics, you have to write rules around it, then something's gone wrong, because fundamentally that sort of compass has gone wrong, and the purpose of the business has been lost. And the job of the executive really is to make it very clear that business, it's not about making money. If the chief executive of my company stood up and said, you know, all we care about is profit, I wouldn't work here. And even if I was a beneficiary of that, of the success of that plan, because I wouldn't align myself with that goal. I wouldn't say I'm not going to come to work every day solely driven on profit. The purpose here is to do some good, to enjoy doing it, to build a long-term sustainable business. And yet we have to make a profit.
I think there's a practical problem, Steve, that we have to deal with, and that is that there are very few companies, I think, that has your philosophy. Most companies are profit-driven. Most companies have financial goals that have to be met. And as was the case in Enron, most of the ethical issues that cropped up were issues that arose from the pressure that leaders put on their companies to achieve certain financial goals. And that played havoc with the ethical standards at the time, I believe. That said, Stephen, without giving you an opportunity to reply right now, we are at the end of the second segment. And I think what I would very much like to talk about in the next segment, our final segment, is this whole issue about motivation and how that's taught in the business schools. So let's do that when we get back.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
It's time to take a new look at some of life's changing moments. It's time to listen to an expert who has been there and can provide insight through experience, studies, and enlightening guests. Tune in to Illuminating Now, Lindsay's Life Secrets. Host Lindsay Levinson takes a look at relationships, parenting, health and wellness, divorce, depression, sexuality, philanthropy, and mental health. You'll look at everything you know in a different way. Illuminating Now, Lindsay's Life Secrets, airs Wednesdays at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
Families today face unique challenges. Marriage, parenting, and family forms have changed a lot in the last century. Family Matters with Dr. Virginia Collin will focus on building and maintaining healthy family relationships. We will discuss marriage, divorce, family mediation, parenting, lifestyles, and mental health. All kinds of family matters. Our show will feature guest experts and your participation, too. You can listen to Family Matters live every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific on Voice America Variety.
Want to help make our world a better place, but not sure where to start? Tune into Better Worldians Radio with the creators of the social game on Facebook called A Better World. Join hosts Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel, who will inspire you to make a big difference in small ways. They'll speak to experts, authors, volunteers, and everyday people who are changing the world daily. Better Worldians Radio is heard live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time, on Voice America Variety.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
You are listening to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. To find out more about our program, please visit www.dreamersandwinners.com. Now, back to this week's program.
Okay, we're back.
Time flies.
I wish I could treat this more seriously. Okay, so Diane, in a previous show, Steve and I chatted about motivating people. And I think if I were to summarize the result of that discussion, it was exactly what Steve had just said, which is how important it is that people enjoy doing what they're doing. And that it's impossible to motivate somebody, I think, if they don't enjoy what they're doing. And in fact, Daniel Pink spoke about how there are extrinsic and intrinsic motivators. The extrinsic motivators, obviously, are just money. And the intrinsic ones relate to why people do what they do. And I was just curious about the business school's approach to the teaching of motivation.
Well, the approach is that it's pretty much left up to each instructor. We are required to deliver certain content.
But would there be an exam question, for example, relating to techniques of motivation?
The closest I can come to that in my class is that there are exam questions on theories of moral reasoning and moral development, which don't go to motivation straight away, but help provide clues as to why some people base their decisions based on group pressure versus a desire to do something for the greatest good. So
Before Steve leaps in, let me ask you something. Isn't this a huge flaw in the way that business schools teach their students? Because, and I'm not looking at this from an academic point of view, I'm looking at it from a totally practical point of view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've run a few businesses. Steve's been involved in much larger businesses than I've been involved in. And I don't know whether Steve would agree, but I have to tell you that in my opinion, the single greatest attribute in a leader is being able to motivate those whom he is working or she is working mm-hmm. with. Mm-hmm. And it's almost inconceivable to me that a business school curriculum would not focus on motivation, because how do you make a business work other than by motivating people?
Right. And we do have a school of leadership, and there are schools of leadership, and your points are well taken. I mean, quite frankly, I think there's so much need for reform in business schools. I don't even know where to start. But that's a good point, especially since I've had the experience of team teaching with the executive in residence for 2 years, and he does that for students. He tells them about his career experience, how important it was to work with his employees and motivate them and give examples. So I agree. There's a deficiency there overall, because right now it's kind of left up to who wants to do that and what classes.
Well, I just have to tell you, and I'll leave this to Steve, I'm Steve's authorized representative and agent, and I'm prepared to...
Oh, I see.
I don't know. Why are you laughing? I mean, why are you laughing? I mean, you know, I've got food I have to get on the table, you know?
Yes. What's the speaker's fee? That's my next question.
Oh, we can discuss that later.
All right.
More important is...
We already said it's not about money. It's not about
right, money. Right. That's true. That's true.
No, the speaker is not interested in money, but the agent is.
You know? Oh, I see.
But the plot thickens. But Michael's point, I think, is well made. And, you know, the way I think about it is that, business is a journey. You know, it never ends. So you don't, when you get paid and make a profit, that's not the end of the relationship. It's just a signpost on the journey. Mm. And in order to undertake a journey, you know, you have to know where you are and you have to know what the destination is. So otherwise you're just wandering around aimlessly. And I think motivation is about goal setting. Mm. That if people can understand the destination, what are we trying to do here? They can actually get themselves involved. They can buy into it and they will find a way to do it. You don't have to tell somebody how to get from A to B. You just have to tell them the plan is to get to B and then they will figure it out. And I would say in businesses, and I, you know, Michael's right, I've been involved in very large businesses that have lots of subparts. And the parts that don't do well are usually because nobody really understands the objective. They don't. They've got smart people, and they're a little bit confused. They haven't got a very clear destination. Nobody's set very clear goals. And they just want somebody, quite often they will say, I just want somebody to tell me what they want me to do. And that's confusion. And I don't want to tell people what to do. What I want to do is I want to tell them what we're trying to do and ask them if they can help us to do it. And that goal setting for me is really key, because you give people enough creative freedom, whatever they're doing, to be able to make good decisions. And everybody is pointing in the same direction. Everybody is trying to work together to reach that destination, point B. And I think that's when businesses are successful. The power of people is incredible when they're all focused on the objective. And the biggest failure in motivation is people not setting very clear objectives.
But Diane, you know, there's something else, just to leap in here quickly, that relates directly to your field, you know, the field of ethics, is that I believe that if the leaders instill in their organizations the fact that people like working with people they like and trust, and that people want to work with ethical people, then ethics suddenly assumes a real practical perspective on everyone's radar.
Right.
And then,
because you've, yeah.
Yeah, and then those who are watching you are asking the question in the context of ethics, because that's one of the goals that Steve's talking about.
Because both of you have just put ethics where it belongs, within the context of relationships, in which trust is important, goals are important, mutual understandings of the goals are important.
Now, I for me, it's about these idea of goals. So, I mean, the philosopher I like is Bruce Lee.
I see.
You know, and you know, and you know, because I love that Bruce Lee, you know, the Bruce Lee comment. He said, I can't, it's something like the most successful warrior is the average man who has laser-like focus.
Oh.
And I think if you give somebody a goal and they're absolutely focused on it, the average person will achieve amazing things. And
yeah, but I think it goes one step further, Stephen, that I think that a goal is fine, but you have to make very clear why that's your goal.
Mm. Why?
You have to sell the why.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, people have to buy into it. But I think it's this idea that, you know, anybody, you don't have to sort of employ the greatest brains in the world. What you have to do is you get people focused on what you're trying to do. And I think that people can actually, when they buy into it, they can do amazing things. Mm. And it's the power of synergy, the power of teamwork. I mean, certainly in my business, it's the, you know, nobody, we're designing amazing buildings and nobody can do it alone. So it's all about teamwork. How do you get a team to do amazing things? They all have to buy into a principle. And then that laser-like focus just creates that sort of unbeatable warrior. And that's really what we're trying to do. And we're trying to do that every time. You add it all up and you have an amazing business. And it, yes, it's profitable because you're doing those things that everybody is believes they've got a value, and the value is being realized day to day. And then they do amazing things.
And I'm surmising that one of the values is quality.
Now, all of those, you know, all of those things are important. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't, you know, repeat business comes from getting it right. So, you know, the clients, because that creates trust. I mean, if we didn't have quality and we were getting it wrong, then the trust would be eroded. You know, we're taking on somebody's investing a huge amount of money in something and they expect it to work. And so that's quality. It has to be right. And I think that it almost goes without saying. I mean, the long-term relationships require that you do high quality work.
But
to get high quality work out of people, they have to care about it, and to care about it, they have to believe in it, and to believe in it, they have to know, what are we trying to achieve, what is the goal? And I think it's fairly simple, and one thing leads to another. And you know, there's no need to overcomplicate it. In the context of ethics, the question really is, when people come across that moment in time where they can take a shortcut or cheat, you know, what stops them doing that? What stops them saying no? That is that is wrong. And I think that's about, it's about their mates, letting their mates down, doing something wrong, seeing that it's a short-term gain that will damage the long-term relationship, and therefore their business conscience makes them do the right thing. That's really what we want. And you know, can you teach that in business school? I don't know. I think the values they're something that those people should be chosen because they believe in those things. There's some sort of selection process that requires it.
Ideally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see, from my perspective, I think it can be taught, because in my experience, I know that if I will tell a group of people that certain things are very, very important to me, and how I'm going to judge you is going to be based on those things. And one of the things that are important to me is this whole issue of trust, and that you're going to act honestly, you're going to act ethically, and if you make a mistake, you'll fess up to it and just do better next time. If people realize that that's what is going to drive them in the organization, they're going to pay attention. And I think the real problem that I have with a lot of these kids coming up is that they don't understand that. And a lot of the problem with the leaders is that they don't sort of express what Steve has expressed. And on this issue of quality, I just have to say this. You know, there are a gazillion lawyers in this world. California, it's a joke, okay? Everybody you bump into is either, you know, an aspiring actress, producer, or a lawyer.
You know? My God!
And there's no shortage of good lawyers. Make all the jokes you want to make about lawyers. There are some really, really good lawyers. Quality is not the issue, in my opinion. You can always find somebody to give you quality work. What's important is something that Steve said ages ago, and which I've always been preaching, which is that people like doing business with people they like and trust. And you only trust people who are ethical. If you see somebody doing something unethical, you know that that's how they may treat you one day. And for the life of me, I don't understand why that's not a concept that the business schools aren't drumming into people every day. And in the context of cheating at business school, what could be worse? If you're going to cheat on an exam, you're going to cheat on anything. And why would you ever hire somebody who cheats?
Exactly.
And you know, so to me, this isn't about quality. It's about values.
I agree.
And everybody in business that I've ever come into contact with, both business and in law and consulting, they want to do, frankly, what's best for them. They want to make their name in the organization. And if they know that they don't have a prayer if they act unethically or appear to be acting unethically, I think that's going to temper the way they behave. And I will go one step further. I'm not sure which is worse, those who cheat or those who look away when those around them cheat. And in the business school context, what remains a total mystery to me is how the deans can stand by and allow cheating to occur. This is all about leadership.
So it goes back to the kind of culture that the executive shapes.
Right. It's the title of your book, Diane.
I'm really interested in that because of what you just said. And I will say that business schools have a long way to go, but there are some business schools that are really trying to make a difference, and in the way you all would approve of. And it may sound a little bit self-serving. I'm not referring to myself, but the field of business ethics and corporate responsibility started in the 1970s here in the States. And that group of scholars has been trying to give the kind of message that's been talked about here and be in conversation with ethical leaders. And so, you know, hopefully we're making some positive difference. But it is a little bit of an uphill struggle on some days.
Nothing's easy, Diane.
Well, and I have no complaints at all.
Well, Steve, I think we're almost there. You want to make some final comments from your perch atop your cathedral?
Yeah, some final comments. I mean, first of all, Diane, you know, thank you. It's really interesting talking to somebody who looks at this from an academic perspective. But I have to say that, you know, just the fact that we are taking ethics seriously, it's really important. I think it's something that it's a requirement of every single individual in every single business to be doing ethically the right thing. And just the fact we're talking about it will help to make things better. So, you know, I appreciate you coming on the show. It's been fun.
I appreciate your having me. And business schools need leaders like both of you to be interested in what we're doing and offering us advice. So that's really a bright spot. Thank you.
Well, let me just end it by saying this, that Diane, I've been following your career because I was always intrigued by how the business schools handle this issue of ethics after Enron. And you have been an absolute champion, and I believe that you've often taken unpopular positions with the business schools, but that what you've done has been absolutely inspiring.
Oh, thank you.
So you should be really congratulated. All right. Well, thanks again, both of you.
Yeah,
appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Speak soon. As for our next week's show, I don't yet have a clue, but stay tuned. It'll be interesting.
Thank you for tuning in to Dreamers, Winners, and Making a Difference with Michael Friedlander. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Until then, Michael encourages you to keep daring to dream and to remember what Nelson Mandela once wrote, namely that a winner is a dreamer who never gives up.